Welcome everybody to our latest Employment Law 101 series. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Peter. I'm a partner with MPM Legal. We're a specialist employment and business immigration firm here in the UK, but we work with companies that are all around the world which have a common interest, and that's employing people here in England. I am, as ever, delighted to be joined today by my colleague, Adrienne. Morning, Adrienne.
Morning, everybody. Hi, Peter.
And today's hot topic is the future of post-termination restriction. In particular, we're going to be talking about non-compete clauses. Just a little bit of housekeeping before we get into it. As always, these sessions are recorded. We post them onto our website, links up onto LinkedIn as well afterwards. So if you miss anything and you want to come back and revisit some of the discussion points, then you'll be able to in a few days' time. On that note, all of the audio from our webinars are turned into a lovely podcast and hosted on Spotify and I think Apple Music as well, actually, though I've not checked that out. But all of our back catalogue is on Spotify. So if you're looking for a little bit of, not so light entertainment when you're out walking the dog or jogging or driving into the office, if you still do such a thing, then find us on Spotify as well. In terms of today, you'll see at the bottom of the screen, there's a Q&A box. We absolutely love questions. So, if they're employment law related, we like them anyway. So if you've got...
And if we can answer them.
And if we can answer them, they're the best ones. So if you've got any questions, please do ask them. We'll try and answer them as we go along. We're not going to identify you unless you'd like us to. We're not going to open up your microphone like I've seen other people do on other webinars before. So we can keep it all secret and private, but please do stick your questions into the Q&A function at the bottom and just let us know your thoughts. Let us know your thoughts generally, really. So we are kicking off today on non-compete clauses. I'm just wondering, Adrian, if I just run that poll about non-compete clauses from the get-go, just to get a feel for how people use them, really.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Yeah, see if you can get that to work. But just to be clear, we're talking about non-competes after employment ends, because obviously it's part of the duty of fidelity of an employee not to compete with their employer during their employment. But obviously restricting competition after employment ends is another matter entirely. And as I'm sure everybody knows, it's common for there to be non-compete restrictions in an employment contract, but they are very tough to enforce. We have actually covered this in a previous topic, but essentially the rule of thumb is that they should go no further than is necessary to protect your legitimate interests. And the burden of proof is going to be on the company to demonstrate not only what those legitimate interests are, but also how the covenant can protect it. There's loads of hurdles for an employer to clear to enforce them, including looking at the level of the employee, which is, broadly how involved they are with the running of the business. Are they part of the directing mind and decision making of the business, or whether they have such valuable skills that if they left and went to a competitor, they could do an amount of damage. And again, an employer has to show that that damage would actually occur. And, courts will always take into consideration other restrictions and confidential information protection to see if those restrictions would do the job that the employer is looking for, rather than having to enforce a non-compete. So the reason we're talking about this today, and the reason Peter's asking for a poll, is what's the plan for the future, and is this something that we definitely need to keep our eyes on?
Yeah, absolutely. Just in terms of that poll, thanks for responding, everybody. I think 87% of you use some form of non-compete within your business. 13%, as you do the maths then, of you don't. So that's quite interesting. I know that we a few of you will be HR consultants that work with other businesses as well. And I assume you just answer on behalf of maybe what the majority of your clients do. Why this is topical for us, by the way, if you want to look back through our back catalogue, you'll be able to find that deeper dive on what happens after the employment relationship ends and, saying goodbye, but still being tied in some way. So if you're looking for a deeper dive into post-termination restrictions, restrictions, and you can find that webinar in our back catalogue. But what prompted today is a couple of things, really. Back in 2020, the government launched a consultation process regarding reform on the ban of post-termination restrictions. And I think this is one of Boris Johnson's pet projects. I remember him championing the concept of it. Now, that consultation closed in February 2021. So we're coming up for 2 years ago now since the consultation closed down, and we've actually had no follow-up since then. But in answer to a parliamentary question in March last year, one of the business ministers, Paul Scully, I have to confess, I don't know if he's still a business minister, but Paul Scully did report that the government are analysing the responses to the consultation at the moment. And once they've got through that analysis, they are intending to publish an outcome to the consultation on non-compete clauses, which will be published on the government website. So we just take that as it's in the system, it's been looked at, and the system is going to spit out a response at some point. Now, we'll come in to talk about other jurisdictions shortly and what's going on. But for the purposes of the UK, the reason for the consultation really came down to the government trying to find ways to kickstart economic recovery after Brexit. And, of course, in 2020, we then had the pandemic hitting as well. And really, the view was to support economic recovery from the impacts of COVID-19. The government wants to explore ways of boosting innovation, creating the condition for new jobs, and to increase competition as well. And we know that the government is really keen to promote the UK as having this entrepreneurial culture, particularly in emerging technologies. When you look at things like advanced robotics, artificial intelligence, plug there for our ChatGPT webinar we did a few weeks ago, blockchain as well. I can't pretend to know anything about blockchain at all. But there's a commonly held view that non-compete clauses really do stifle competition and have a knock-on stifling impact on growth in the economy as well. So the reforms that the consultation were looking at, two central concepts really. The first is a complete outright ban on non-compete clauses, complete ban. So for the 80-something percent of you that are using them within your business, that's obviously going to have quite a dramatic effect. The other proposal, though, would equally have quite a dramatic effect, certainly in terms of cost, and that's paying an employee during any post-termination period of restriction also. So I mentioned other jurisdictions. Adrienne, let's just talk a bit, I think, about what happens elsewhere.
Yeah, because these ideas for reforms just haven't come out of the ether. Obviously, the government has looked at what other jurisdictions do. So, for example, in a lot of European jurisdictions, France, Germany, I think Italy as well, the situation is broadly similar to the UK in terms of enforceability, protecting legitimate business interests. But the additional point is that if the employer wants to enforce the restrictions after termination of employment, some payment has to be made for that period of restriction. I think in France, it's generally around 40% of salary. So it's not the employee's full salary, but about 40% of the salary in order to make it enforceable. Then we've got, obviously, the US, and California in particular is well known across the US. It was once the hotbed of tech startups. I'm sure it probably wants to say it still is the hotbed of tech startups, but non-competes are expressly void in California, and therefore businesses, that, I mean, that's obviously something that's very attractive to businesses, but also businesses have to then be quite creative about how to get around the ban on non-competes. And they have a lot of focus on having a proper plan in place for protecting their trade secrets, their confidential information, where that's stored, who has access to it, generally relying on sort of alternatives for business protection. And I've read somewhere as well that deferred incentive plans to make sure that the employee isn't a naughty person after they've left. So the plans are deferred only after a period of time. So that encourages that good behaviour. So, you know, these are the types of things I think that the government are looking to match if they're looking to make the UK an attractive place to start business.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, just sticking with what's happening across the pond, this is the most interesting development for me and part of the impetus for having this discussion today. And that is, in January of this year, the Federal Trade Commission in the US. Now, that's the government body which protects consumers from anti-competitive and unfair business practices. So the FTC has proposed a new rule banning employers from imposing non-compete clauses, full stop. And that's because in their view, non-compete clauses are widespread, often exploitative practice which suppress wages, hampers innovation, and blocks entrepreneurs. And the FTC estimates that wages could be increased by $300 billion as a result of their proposed changes, and also expand career opportunities for up to 30 million Americans. Now, there's a public consultation that's underway at the moment, and that's following a preliminary finding by them that non-compete clauses are an unfair method of competition and in violation of US law. So that's pretty significant. I mean, they've produced this kind of fact sheet here, which sets out a little bit more information. I think clearly trying to get businesses on side and consumers on side as to the merits of banning non-compete clauses. They estimate that in the States, 18% of US workers are covered by non-competes, which I have to say does feel, I'd have guessed it was higher actually, but I bet if you broke it down into specific industry and specific management levels, you're gonna get, you know, real concentrations. But they think, as I say, increasing workers' earnings, they think consumers would save up to $148 billion dollars on healthcare costs each year. And that's because they've identified anti-competitive practices within the healthcare industry because innovation is stifled. And they think it would double the number of companies in the same industry founded by a former worker as well. So really chiming in with the entrepreneurial approach that they want to take. And also they're appealing to equality issues because they think that banning non-competes nationwide may close racial and gender wage gaps by between 3.5% and 9%, which obviously interesting to see whether that plays out or not. So this consultation is going on, but the FTC have clearly taken a view that these non-compete clauses are widespread and that in many cases, employers are using what is an outsized bargaining power to coerce workers into accepting the terms. And, you know, my question is, will the government take, the UK government take a similar stance? You know, I think they'll be keeping a close watch on what's happening in the States. Now, if these proposals come in, what they will do is they'll make it illegal for an employer to enter into or attempt to enter into a non-compete clause. They'll make it illegal for an employer to maintain an existing non-compete clause. And they'll also make it illegal for a business to represent to a worker that the worker is subject to a non-compete clause.
I'm completely fascinated by this. I just want to play devil's advocate for 1 minute, because in my experience, the phrase cake and eat it springs to mind, because, you know, it's, I can totally understand, although I'd like to see the evidence behind some of those numbers, because there's some big numbers bandied about there by the FTC, you know, both in terms of closing gaps and cost savings, et cetera, all the rest of it. But Here's my devil's advocate position. So on the one hand, great for competition. There can be employee movement across all these entrepreneurial companies. And that's fantastic when you want an employee to join you, right? So it's like we get clients coming to us going, can you take the look at these restrictions? We really want this guy, but we don't want to end up in litigation because of the restrictions. And it's annoying. It's a bar to recruitment. I totally get that. But what about when the person's leaving the business? Then it's a case of, well, we've got this entrepreneurial setup. Very often it's a new to market idea. They want to make sure that it's utterly protected. Is there not an argument to say that that makes a place where such restrictions aren't in available to an employer, that makes it perhaps a little bit less attractive? I mean, I don't know, because, you know, they would say it's more difficult to protect their business if somebody, their own employee, would leave to go to another competitor. That's why I think it's the cake and eat it. You want employees to come in, but you also want to have some control over what they can do when they go out the door. And I think
from an employee's perspective, though, that is, isn't it?
I'm looking at it from an, if I'm an entrepreneur and I want to invest heavily in somebody, you know, bring them into the heart of my business, etc., all the rest of it, I don't want them walking out the door, going down the road and, you know, setting up a competing business. Do you see what I mean? So
yeah,
that's
what
my.
I would say is how many entrepreneurs are sat there employed in another business thinking, I've got this, I'm doing this thing for my employer, but I can do it so much better.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can do it so much better, but I'm not allowed to go and try and do it better because I've got to sit out for 12 months or I've got to sit out for 6 months.
I just think it's quite interesting. And I think actually that's the bit where we can, we'll maybe come on to it in a bit when we wrap up the session about what else can be done as from a business protection point of view. But let's just dig into the proposed reforms a little bit more anyway. That was just my little side snippet of being devil's advocate. So we've got, what about mandatory pay?
Mandatory pay is one of the central themes of it. One of the two core ideas that are being subject to consultation. So some employers are already doing this in a way because of the method of using garden leave. So, you know, when we think about garden leave, the employee remains employed under the terms of their employment contract. They get paid as usual, but they don't do any work. So we don't give them any work to do. We kind of neutralize them, if you like. We take them away from dealing with customers. They're not dealing with any business contacts. And the aim there is obviously to break any relationships and hope that by the time that their employment does actually come to an end at the end of the garden leave period, any confidential information that they may be privy to, any contacts and everything are stale. You know, the information's gone stale and outdated. So they pose less of a commercial risk. Their usefulness to a competitor has diminished over that time. If mandatory pay has been brought in, then the employer's going to have to put the money where the mouth is, really, and just pay up to get the protection that they say that they need. And in my experience, when employers have been asked about doing this, when it's been positioned, they're not willing to. Now, maybe that's because they think, well, at the moment, the UK legislative regime doesn't provide for it. You know, there have been plenty of cases where non-compete clauses restricting competitive activity have been upheld. So why should we put our hand in our pocket?
That's an interesting one, though, isn't it? I've had cases where I'm acting, with sort of like global aspects, and there've been contracts in other jurisdictions, and employers have said, you know, we've got to pay if we want to enforce the post-termination restriction they've gone on, and we're not going to do that. But then equally, if you think about the costs of enforcing after the event, you know, and the uncertainty of enforcement, you've got the potential damage to the business, you've got certainly the legal fees of bringing a case for enforcement. It's not the cheapest of cases, is it?
It's absolutely not the cheapest of cases. Discussions I've had with clients this week about the relative cost involved in it, and it really focuses the mind in terms of how important is this to us. Let me just jump in, actually, because I did have another poll to launch about this question of mandatory pay. I stupidly didn't name my polls very well, so I think this is the right one, so bear with me. Here we go. So I've just launched this poll, so feel free to have a look at this and give us your response. The question is, would you be willing to pay for a restricted period? If you're an HR consultant, well, you can answer in a personal capacity. You can answer on the basis of what you think your clients would be willing to do. So let me just leave that ticking along for a little bit, and then I'll share the results in a moment. I think you're going to say something about the power balance. The complementary measures.
Yeah, so one of the other reforms is, and it goes hand in hand with this sort of the payment for the period, is one of the proposals in place is that that employers would have to be transparent about the non-compete provisions before employment starts. Now, I read this in the consultation period, and I have to confess to being completely baffled by this, to be honest, because most employment contracts that I've seen are issued ahead of employment starting, and they contain the restrictions. I wasn't sure how that would be any different. Now, I'm sure that many of you will put your hand up and go, oh, sometimes we don't give the employment contracts until after the employee started. So maybe that's the aspect that the consultation paper is trying to catch.
And I just say, you know, like, I know you will have had the same conversation that I've had with individual employee clients in the past, where say they're signing a settlement agreement that refers to them reaffirming post-termination restrictions that they've given in the past.
Yeah.
Oh, I've not read them. Or yeah, I haven't read them for 10 years since I started my job. Or I didn't know there were any restrictions in my employment contract. Where are they then?
Yeah.
And I just wanted
to maybe this needs to be called out more. Yeah, maybe it needs to be called out more. So, like, here's, you know, we're delighted we're going to offer this to you. It's all very exciting. Look at all these lovely benefits. This is an amazing job for you. By the way, you should know that if you try to leave us, we're going to handcuff you severely and you might not be able to start your own business for 6 months. Look forward to you joining us. I mean, it's just this hilarious message in my view. But anyway, look, that's just one of the proposals that might come in. So I would be very interested to see how people will respond to that. But, you know, just coming back to the point about balance of power, I think the issue there is generally, and shoot me if that is a big generalization, the employee is going to want the job, right? So if the employee turns around and says, I'm not happy about those restrictions, what is the balance of power between potential employer, potential employee that gives them good standing to be able to reject it? It's quite rare that I've seen a candidate walk away from a job where they've objected to the restrictions. It has happened, and it depends very much industry to industry, but by and large, employees will be up for the job. That's why they've applied for it in the first place. And they've kind of gone, well, I don't really feel like I'm in a position to be able to reject the restrictions. Don't know what you think on that, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have given advice to, say, senior execs who are commencing employment, and they've come to us and said, look, sense check of the service agreement I'm signing, and there's been a bit of negotiation in terms of the restrictions. So whilst they haven't been a deal breaker, there's been an opportunity to actually reformulate the restrictions to make them something that the incoming employee is a lot more comfortable with. But there's an obvious downside to that, is which you're negotiating on the way in, you're probably tightening up the restrictions and actually making them more enforceable. But, you know, you're going into it with your eyes open, so it's a decision, but it is quite often an unequal bargaining position. Just coming back to this poll. So thank you for everyone that responded. Results are quite fascinating. Finely balanced. 48% of you would be willing to pay for a restricted period, and 52% of you wouldn't be willing to pay for a restricted period. So like an almost even split.
That's interesting. I think we should follow up on that, Peter. Just to warn everybody out there, then, you might find a more detailed poll being come out by us, because what I would like to understand is whether or not that relates to you want to have a bit more freedom to decide which level of employee you would pay for and others that you wouldn't. So, yeah, well, I think we should do that.
Yeah, senior leadership team you might be willing to pay for, but somebody else you might not be.
Anyway, let's come on to the other bit.
Ban them entirely. So they just completely disappear, which is obviously the route that the Federal Trade Commission and the states are looking at doing. That's what they're consulting on at the moment. Though they're a step ahead of us because they've made this preliminary finding that they are anti-competitive, and we don't have that finding over here.
I wonder if it's a step too far, though. I mean, the thing about the FTC in the US is that they've already got a strong, innovative state which has made the ban already. So to that extent, I think they're a couple of steps further down the line. I mean, certainly the commentary that I've read is that it's unlikely that there would be an outright ban, but it may be that this is an incremental pathway towards that. So we could find that we go step one, you'll have to pay for post-termination restrictions. And then, you know, who knows, in 10 years time, there could be a further review that also takes 3 years to come to fruition. But anyway, and that way we head towards a ban.
Yeah, I mean, and by the time we've retired from employment practice, then maybe something will have happened, perhaps. But I mean, other legal commentators do seem to think it's not so likely there is going to be a complete ban. I mean, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure, really, because actually, when you look at the sort of mood music at the moment, there's been, I mean, in the news the last couple of weeks, there's a big thing about trying to get workers back into the workplace. The government clearly thinks it's got a problem. It's got a problem with people of a certain age who have left the workplace and are not returning, allegedly. I think there's a dispute over the interpretation of some of the data. It says it's got a problem in terms of trying to encourage women to return to the workplace after taking maternity leave, and issues around childcare costs, which are, you know, heavily focused in the media at the moment. This is another part of that puzzle, I think. I mean, if the government are genuine about a strategy to encourage entrepreneurship, to deregulate, to remove friction in terms of, you know, free market economics, et cetera, et cetera, this is part of that. And removing non-compete clauses. See, I don't think that it's not the disaster that it might sound, because non-compete clauses are not the only means of protection, right? Within a business.
No. And actually, that kind of... that kind of leads us on to a couple of questions that we've had. So we've got a couple of questions in a similar way. So I think we can probably tackle this together in terms of the impact for employers. So let's roll the clock forward and assume that there's a ban on non-competes. One of the questions is there enough protection from confidentiality clauses in contracts of employment? How do we really know if your ex-employee is being naughty? And then I think that links with another question. From a business protection perspective, do you think there might be a formalised assessment as part of the exit process to ascertain the risk someone poses to the business they are leaving? Now, certainly what I've read, answering that second part first, exactly that type of exit process takes place or is recommended to take place in California, for example. So it's a matter of form that that the employer would have a scooch through the employee's emails, for example, to see if there's any potential risk. It sounds very draconian, but you know, if you're in a state where non-competes, etc., are everybody knows that they're not enforceable, then it's just one of the things that you can do in terms of protecting your business.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for those questions. I mean, I think this ties in with what we're going to talk about around impact for employers. I think about these proposals and just the sort of general other steps that we can get to in terms of protection. So we're talking here about confidential information, intellectual property provisions as well. So how well drafted are your employment contracts? Do you have NDAs in place? Do you have watertight confidentiality provisions within the contract itself? If you've got somebody that is creating intellectual property for you and that's your kind of trade secret / secret squirrel stuff, to what lengths do you go to protect it? But I think what's written down in an employment contract and what you've got in an all singing, all dancing policy is only really one part of the picture as well, because the most significant part is what's happening day to day on a practical level. And I mean, Adrian and I were talking before about clients that have employees using personal mobiles, not giving, what's it called? Bring your own device to work. BYOD. So yes, there are advantages to that approach, people using their own laptops, using their own mobile devices, but there's a downside where people are accessing or storing very sensitive personal information and very sensitive information pertaining to commercial interests for your business. And then they pose some kind of flight risk and some sort of competition risk to you as well. So what practical steps are you managing around that? Is it actually sensible that you provide the hardware for people to work from? So then you can be absolutely 100% fully in control over how it's utilized and what inbuilt protections you've got to that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things, just, you know, even storing of information, you think if you've got somebody who is the face of your business going out, being the salesperson to your customers, and they use their own mobile phone, so their mobile phone is littered with your business contacts, how on earth do you get that back when they leave? I mean, I am still surprised how many businesses allow employees to use their own personal mobile phones, don't provide them with company phones. That is one of the practical steps, I think, that can be taken. Keep control of your own kit.
Yeah, completely. A couple of other points that people have made. So Elaine, thanks for your comment. If they want to make the UK attractive, they should not increase corporation tax. I mean, there's like a whole other webinar.
One of many.
About this of the UK. Anonymous asks a question about if a solicitor or barrister switches firms or chambers and clients of that person also switch to the same firm or chamber, how would the firm or chamber deal with the non-compete clause? Has the barrister breached? I hope you're not a solicitor or a barrister asking that question in anticipation of leaving and joining somewhere. I mean, first of all, barristers generally are self-employed, I think. So there's probably, I doubt they're restricted in the same way anyway. But in terms of solicitors, and this goes for any employee, I mean, the devil's in the detail. It depends how the restriction's drafted, because this is the point we're making around non-competes not being the be-all and end-all, because there might be, you might not have a restriction on non-compete. So take the example of a solicitor moving to a competitive law firm, there might not be that restriction in there, because the way that you protect your business is have a non-dealing or a non-solicitation clause instead. So you have a restriction in your contract instead that says you won't deal with these clients for a certain period of time, or you won't deal with these suppliers, or you won't try and poach any of our key employees to prevent team moves as well. So there's more than one way to skin a cat, as the saying goes, and you might have to look beyond the use of non-competes. You will have to. I mean, if you're one of the 48% that don't want to pay for a non-compete restricted period, then if these changes happen, you're not going to want to do that. So you're going to have to look elsewhere for restrictions anyway. And, you know, if you're not using non-competes, then I think you're already protecting your business in other ways. And the key is just to making sure that those protections are actually fit for purpose.
And that's quite interesting. That also ties in with one of the other questions about sort of like more geographically based businesses. So like you see so many restrictive covenant cases about hairdressers, estate agents. The person who's asked the question is absolutely right. A lot of this has come from that. So what I call geographical, you shall not set up a competing shop within 2 miles or whatever. So that's where the other restrictions, which are unlikely to be affected, so non-solicitation of customers, non-poaching of staff, those types of things, they're going to become an awful lot more useful because enforceability is less of an issue. So essentially, the court doesn't like to enforce anything that potentially prevents an employee from earning a living. Because if you say to a guy, you've only been in that industry for 20 years, you can't go and work for a competitor for 6 months, they will validly say, well, I then can't earn a wage, can't support my family. So the attractiveness of the other restrictions is that basically gives the message, go work wherever you like. But what you can't do when you get there is poach our staff or our customers for a period of time. And that's a lot more palatable to courts. So, you know, in terms of the geographical location issues, that's about pinning down poaching of staff and just making sure you've got protection that way. One of the other things I think is really useful and is overlooked, repeats what we said before, essentially, is about making sure you use your garden leave properly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is just an easy win. If you've got the contractual ability to put people on garden leave when they hand their notice in, you think that they pose a risk, then use it, frankly. Yeah. The argument against doing so is always, well, we need this person to carry on doing the work. And I guess it's a balancing exercise between what's the commercial risk involved in them working out a 3-month notice period, for example, i.e. actually being on the premises or dealing with your customers and clients. And how do you balance that against them just sitting at home? So you're to use my phrase again, neutralizing them for that period as well. So you know, use the tools that you've got already inbuilt into your contracts, because they can be easily overlooked. The other point on that is, you know, notice periods as well. If you've got a 1-month notice period in place for valuable staff, then how do you think you're going to be able to argue that a 6-month restricted period is proportionate? I think you're going to have a bit of an uphill challenge. It's going to be very, very difficult to do that. Coming back to garden leave, you can use that period to embed the customer relationships with somebody new that's coming in as well. Another comment, I understand staff and customers can go with the employee. It's their choice. It's proving the employees poach them. Yeah, I mean, actually, it depends on the interpretation of the non-dealing clause. So if there's a clause saying that you can't deal with certain staff and customers, it doesn't matter if the customers want to go with that person. You can restrict someone from dealing with them. But that's where the commercial considerations come into play. We have these interesting discussions where a key client might say, I'm going to take all my business to this other person. I'm going to take it all elsewhere unless you let me deal with this other person on this particular thing. And it becomes a commercial judgment call, really, about what you're willing to release. Before we wrap up, I just wanted to say, if you've got any feedback on these sessions, then please do engage with us on LinkedIn. It would be fantastic to get your feedback on them. We'll be formulating our series that starts again in the autumn once this current one ends towards the end of March. So if anyone has any burning topics and they'd like us to cover and look at later this year, but in the next season of these 101 webinars, then please do drop us a line, comment on LinkedIn, or send an email through as well. Don't forget about incoming employees with post-termination restrictions, because that's the other side of the coin. So although you might be worried about how you're protecting your current business, then the shoe might be on the other foot. Don't forget about obligations that you might owe to a new employee's past employer in terms of inducing breach of contract type arguments as well. So that's a risk area to look out for. In the meantime, we're going to await and see when the outcome of this consultation lands on our desks and what it says. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in the States. Their consultation, for any of you that are joining from the US or have got US business interests, the FTC consultation period ends at the end of March this year. So you've got an opportunity. If you go on their website, there's some way you can respond to it. In the meantime, we'll hold our breath and wait for the outcome of the UK consultation. We'll, of course, let you know once that comes through. In the meantime, this intervening period is a really good opportunity just to stress test what you've got in place, just do a bit of housekeeping and just see what you've got is absolutely fit for purpose. I think that wraps it up from me. Adrienne?
I think so. Yeah, apologies to everybody if we've overrun slightly, but hopefully it was useful and you enjoyed it. And as Peter said, very up for the feedback if you want to drop us a line.
Yeah. Thank you all for joining. Thanks for engaging on the polls and for your questions as well. We'll be back 11 o'clock in 2 weeks' time on another 101 update. So please do join us then. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of the week and have fantastic weekends. Thank you.